This is the McKinsey Podcast, where we help you make sense out of our world's toughest business challenges.
Welcome to the show. I'm Lucia Raheli.
And I'm Roberta Fasaro. These days, carbon dioxide removal may look like a series of one-off technologies and projects for removing toxins from the air. But McKinsey senior partner Mark Patel says it will become a full-fledged industry.
With the regulatory path that we're on across most of the developed nations, and certainly, you know, Europe, North America, the incentives that are being applied also from the public purses to promote the technology development and the projects, we are seeing a material acceleration.
In our first segment, everything you wanted to know about carbon removals, but were afraid to ask.
In our second segment, Black Americans are especially vulnerable to climate change. McKinsey partner Munya Muvezwa shares concrete steps to prevent the deterioration of their lives and livelihoods and the U.S. economy at large.
Mark, thanks for joining the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we all know decarbonization is the most critical response to climate change, but McKinsey's research shows that decarbonization alone may not be enough, right? The report says carbon dioxide removal, or CDR, could play a vital role in combating hard-to-abate emissions. So listen, Mark, consider me a newbie here. What are these hard-to-abate emissions? What do we mean by that?
In terms of the man-made activities, the hard-to-abate emissions and what we call the hard-to-abate sectors, they're hard-to-abate because either they rely on energy from fossil fuels or from inputs that come from fossil-derived sources, or they have activities that create emissions. And when those activities are important to our daily lives, like heating, lighting, materials that we use, and when they're important to our economic growth, it's very hard just to say we're going to cut them off or we're going to stop using them.
What is it about CDR that's so helpful for neutralizing these residual emissions?
The concept of carbon dioxide removal is to say, if we can't entirely cut out the activities that are causing emissions, then let's instead find other mechanisms in which we can remove carbon dioxide or gases that are equivalent to carbon dioxide. We use this term of carbon dioxide removals as a broad term that really describes the fact that we are either taking carbon dioxide that's in the atmosphere or carbon dioxide that's being emitted into the atmosphere and trying to capture it, contain it, store it, or permanently remove it.
If we want to reach net zero targets by 2050, what level of CDR capacity would likely be needed?
Let me take 2030. We say that, you know, our estimates is a big range, but we say our estimates are in the range of 0.8 to 2.9 gigatons of CO2 per year of removal capacity by 2030. Talking about 0.8 or 2.9 gigatons, that's sometimes an abstract concept. What does that actually look like? We talk about the carbon budget of the planet as being around, you know, between 500 and 600 gigatons. We have probably, depending on the climate science that you ascribe to, we are probably at the point of about to or having just passed that budget. What that means is the natural balance of our atmosphere is no longer in balance. And really, to get to the level where we're talking about carbon removals requires a more thorough understanding of what it means to decarbonize or to own the carbon footprint of your business, and to have understood what the different mechanisms are. As you said, the intuitive solution for any company is to work on its own emissions within the business or within the energy that it's sourcing. And so that's where most decarbonization activities begin. Most business leaders across, you know, broad industrial sectors have not yet, I think, been educated, unless their businesses are in high emission, you know, in what I call the high emitter categories, or unless there has been a regulatory reason or a business growth reason that's impacted them. That's not to say that these leaders aren't open-minded and aren't seeking that education, but I think it reflects the fact that we are still relatively early.
In the report, we talk about 4 nature-based removal solutions and 6 technology-based removal solutions. What's the difference between the nature-based and the technology-based?
There are different mechanisms. As you said, we broadly categorize them as nature-based and as technology-based. But even within those definitions, there is a very wide variety. And there is also what I would call a hybrid of nature and engineered or technology-based removals. If I talk about nature, you know, nature has already given us the mechanism for carbon dioxide removal that we all rely on a daily basis. It's photosynthesis. Anything growing is removing carbon dioxide. Most nature-based models start with some form of plant-based matter or biomass, we say, being converted into a state in which it can be stored semi-permanently or permanently. When we talk about engineered or technology-based removals, they range from separation technologies that are all about the physical flow and separation of CO2 into technologies that rely more on chemistry in order to cause the reactions that can help us to convert CO2 or to capture CO2 or other gases that are also damaging and lead to our overall CO2 equivalent footprint.
That's great, Mark. Because you consider these so fun and nature-based and technology-based solutions, I wanted to ask you a little bit about getting an example of, say, your favorite nature-based removal solutions, the potential benefits and, you know, even the potential challenges.
I'll identify myself as being a fan of what we might be able to do in the ocean. The ocean is our biggest carbon sink on Earth. And the reason that I am so interested in the ocean is because of its scale and therefore the potential for scaling removal approaches in the ocean. And because it also has the potential to get us to very low cost. If we look at growing things in and around the ocean or on the ocean, you know, the plants that grow fastest on our planet are generally micro and macroalgae. Mm-hmm. The ability to store CO2 in the ocean is possible through multiple different mechanisms. And a lot of those are captured in what we call enhancement of the alkalinity of the ocean. Mm-hmm. For that reason, I'm particularly interested in what we can be doing, both to preserve the ocean as a carbon sink and to expand the activities that will lead to more carbon removals related to ocean activity.
Can you do the same, Mark, with a tech-based removal solution? What is your favorite there? And what are, you know, what are some of the potential benefits and challenges?
One that's a bit more in the hybrid space, actually, between nature and technology. I think the principle of it has been understood for centuries, but the application of it for the purpose of carbon removal is relatively new. And that's something that we call enhanced rock weathering, ERW. Mm. The principle of enhanced rock weathering is that when you spread rocks on soil, rocks generally in the form of dust or very small rocks, they weather naturally. And in doing so, have the effect of storing carbon in the weathered rock, which then naturally gets washed out through the soil. The application of spreading rocks or rock dust onto soil for fertilizing purposes is centuries old, but most folks didn't naturally attribute it to large volume removal of CO2. Now we have, you know, that happening. There are a number of companies that are embracing that and pursuing it. And again, I like it because it has the characteristics of potentially scaling very quickly and across different geographies.
In the report, we talk a lot about the costs of these solutions and sort of the trade-offs between investing in one or the other. Can you talk a little bit about why the costs associated with one over the other are so different, or what's the challenge there?
We face 2 real challenges when we talk about doing this at scale. We talked about gigatons. Mm. Gigatons of impact means very large volumes of CO2 and therefore very significant deployment of these technologies and the projects that embody the technologies. And if we equate that to, you know, what we're used to in terms of industrial projects and, you know, infrastructure projects, building things and moving things, if you like, then the scale at which we have to do to undertake these different carbon removal approaches is monumental. We're talking about very large portions of arable land, right, that might be used for this, for example, for these enhanced rock weathering technologies, or very extensive deployment of carbon capture, you know, infrastructure. That means, you know, building things, pouring concrete, bending steel, transporting things on boats and land. The question is really, how do we do that in a way that's economic? If we look at today, the costs of doing this, then you have to start at a smaller scale by definition. You have to prove that it works and you prove it at a smaller scale. But whenever you do things like this at a smaller scale, they tend to be much higher cost per unit of CO2. Today, some of these technologies are well over $1,000 per ton of CO2. That's not economic.
Right.
When we talk about what is a reasonable number to get to, I think for anyone in the carbon removal space, you know, the magic numbers start to pop at around $100 per ton, $150 per ton. This is where we want to believe we can get to in the long term.
The report estimates that carbon dioxide removal, the industry for carbon dioxide removal could be worth up to $1.2 trillion by 2050. It also estimates that the cumulative investment required to deliver on net zero by 2050 would be between $6 trillion to $16 trillion, depending on a range of factors. How could investors benefit by making early moves and starting to take action in this space?
This will become an industry. Today, it may look like technologies and projects that are first of a kind or one of a kind projects. But with the regulatory path that we're on across most of the developed nations, and certainly, you know, Europe, North America, the incentives that are being applied also from the public purses to promote the technology development and the projects, we are seeing a material acceleration. And we should expect to continue to see that. As that happens, this will evolve as an industrial sector in its own right. Mm-hmm. We will expect the supply chains for carbon removal to mirror the efficiency and the efficacy of the supply chains that we see for things like energy and materials, food, agriculture. You will plan your inventory for carbon removals. You will buy based on a price that is set by market mechanisms at which you decide it's, you know, it's worth buying and storing more of it. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, we should expect that there will be the opportunities for anyone who's applying capital into establishing that. Now, today, it's the realm of what we call, you know, climate-focused venture capitalists, funds that ultimately are investing pension fund money, money that folks have put into mutual funds. Ultimately, they're choosing to put a portion of that portfolio into these climate investing funds, and those funds are increasingly the ones who are looking to deploy the capital into carbon removals. Mm-hmm. As an individual investor, whether, you know, in any one of those funds, what's the opportunity? It is today to recognize that at some point the supply will be materially constrained relative to the demand. That should be an opportunity for an outsized return, just as it would be in any other sector. And so I think at this point we have many investors who are educating themselves, and they are embracing this as a category for investment, but it still has a lot of diversity in it. And to some extent, there's uncertainty there, depending on what you're used to investing in and how you're used to thinking about it.
Right. What's in it for the suppliers if they start to get an early move on this?
For any supplier that's engaging in this today, the potential is to have a lead in both technology and project development, to turn that into IP that's defensible, just as you would in, you know, in any other sector, mm-hmm. and to build the capabilities that allow you to scale, which will be the other differentiator. there will be brands for carbon removal, right? I mean, it sounds right. like a very strange thing to say that, you know, are we going to brand a ton of CO2? I think we will.
What sort of incentives do we need to create, or sort of how do we gin up that demand for those brands?
The buying landscape today consists of what we call the voluntary market, which is mm-hmm. mostly companies that have made a commitment to decarbonization. And in doing so, whilst they may also be driving a bunch of activities around reducing their own carbon emissions, they're also now engaging in the procurement of carbon credits and purchasing carbon removal credits. There is demand in the future that will come as markets are more regulated that require companies in emitting sectors to participate in purchasing of carbon removals or to conduct it as an activity within their own business. The demand today in the voluntary market is relatively concentrated. The reason for that is that there are a few very large companies who have very large carbon footprints that are growing significantly, who both have committed to aggressive decarbonization goals and have a high level of transparency to how they're achieving them.
Thinking about the demand side, Mark, we talked a little bit about some of the incentives and sort of what needs to change. What else can you say about how we move buyers in that direction, or what are some of the initiatives that are already starting to happen?
We have a high level of innovation now taking place, not just in the carbon dioxide removal technologies and projects, but also in the efforts to accelerate the market. And one of those mechanisms is this concept of advanced market commitment. It's really a concept that we're borrowing from the pharmaceutical and the vaccine world, where the principle is that in order to achieve broad adoption at a low cost, low unit cost, you need to help the developers and the manufacturers to achieve scale. And one of the most effective ways to do that is to provide advanced commitments to purchase, often at a higher price, which these early producers and developers can take to the bank and show that they have customers, even though they are at a much higher cost and a much lower volume than they intend to be. Mm-hmm. So that principle has been adopted in the carbon removals world. The best example, I think, is organization called Frontier, which McKinsey is one of the founding members, where we came together and said, we're ready to buy tons of CO2 from promising carbon removal providers at a high price in the short term in order to help them to grow and scale and reduce their price more quickly over time. We've started in the last 2 years now with Frontier to make purchases from a number of those companies. It's already proving to be very successful in this, in the sense that it's helped those companies to move more quickly to raise capital, to develop their projects, and hopefully to deliver CO2 faster, or CO2 removal, I should say. Mm-hmm. I think there were two aspects of Frontier that were particularly important. One, it is formed in such a way that it significantly streamlines the transaction between a buyer and a seller by conducting the technical and the broader diligence that can give the buyer confidence in participating. So it reduces the transaction cost. And then secondly, and I have to give credit to both the founders of Frontier, the Stripe team, and the other members of Frontier, mm-hmm. it started with sufficient scale. We had an almost $1 billion commitment when it was launched. And that was enough to make, I think, others sit up and say, oh, here's five companies coming together and collectively not just signaling that they might spend $1 billion over time, but actually committing that they're going to do that.
Mark, what does investment look like for the gigaton industry, say, post-2030 and certainly post-2050?
The time frame in which we must establish scale for carbon removals is notionally in that period of between now and 2050. I say that because if we do not scale carbon removals and we do not scale the other approaches to carbon dioxide reduction, most of the climate models point towards us getting to a point where we will see material climate shifts that will be much harder to recover. That's why you see most policies at a national level and now at an international level focusing on how we scale removals in the next 20 years. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that it's one and done, that we'd get to 2050, we'd have got back in balance, let's say, if all went well, and then we would stop worrying about removals. Quite right. The opposite. Our dependence on energy as the driver of economic growth and quality of life means that, you know, the proliferation of more and more consumption of energy globally is only going to put more pressure on us to continue to deliver on these negative emissions, on these removals. And we hopefully will find that it's actually a source of economic acceleration. Mm-hmm. That's what I hope. What I'm going to be very careful about saying is what I think the actual technologies are that win, or the ones that we are using most broadly, because I suspect we're going to see, I think that's the other fun part of this. What we've talked about today are really early generation. I think what's, you know, as with everything, predicting what the technology is going to look like in 30 years, I think that's a very, very dangerous, very dangerous thing to do. But at the same time, you know, technologies have a tendency to deliver much higher efficiency gains than we tend to predict.
I want to thank you for taking this very abstract concept and really, really helping me to understand a lot. And I know it will help our listeners as well. So thank you, Mark. Thanks for joining the podcast.
Thanks so much.
Next up, there's been an increase in the frequency, severity, and intensity of hazardous weather across the United States, and the financial costs are enormous. McKinsey partner Munya Muvezwa is a leader in McKinsey's financial services practice and shares how climate change has a particularly dire impact on Black Americans, as well as the U.S. economy overall.
Munya, thanks for joining the podcast today.
It's great to be here.
Munya, you and the team at McKinsey did some eye-opening research on the effects of climate change on the Black community in the United States, and it's a very rich presentation on our website as well. But let's get to the findings. How are Black people more affected by climate change than other populations?
Number one is location. Half of the Black population in the U.S. is in the south, southeastern part of the country. And when you drill down, they're also disproportionately in census tracts that tend to have a higher likelihood of experiencing severe weather-related events. Number two is what we call climate change impact channels. These impact channels affect areas that are important for Black socioeconomic mobility. For example, severe weather events result in damages to properties, they impact property values, they result in loss of labor productivity, and they cause health-related problems. Number three is the existing socioeconomic disparities. These actually compound the climate change impacts. So, for example, there is already a higher concentration of Black workers in low-wage frontline jobs. Black families save $75 billion less annually than white families. One out of five Black Americans live in food deserts with limited access to fresh, healthy food options, and so on. All these issues combined result in the impacts being disproportionately higher for Black people.
One of the themes that's in the research is this notion of redlining. And I'm curious if you could sort of help define for the audience what redlining is and why its practice is directly linked to the effects of climate change on Black Americans today.
Redlining is an historical practice where services such as mortgage loans and insurance were denied to customers that were residing in neighborhoods that were deemed as risky investments. And this was regardless of the creditworthiness or of the individual customers in these areas. And what was also happening was these areas actually tended to have large concentrations of racial and ethnic minorities. And this practice, we also saw in our research, actually magnifies the impact of climate change for Black people in a number of ways. Firstly, its location, again, as I mentioned. Black populations were forced into less desirable locations. If you look at Baltimore and New Orleans, for example, many historically redlined neighborhoods are in flood zones. In our research, we mapped flood zones in these cities to redlined areas, and there's a very high correlation. During Hurricane Katrina, of the 7 zip codes that incurred the most damage, 4 of those had populations that were at least 75% Black. Second, redlined neighborhoods have a higher temperature occurrence than other neighborhoods in the same city, right? This is due to buildings and asphalt magnifying heat. And this is a phenomenon known as the urban heat island effect. The third impact from redlining and historical practices like that is that redlined areas are also located in what we termed as compromised areas. For example, they're near brownfields where there's contaminated runoff, which can also lead to other public health issues.
Within the research, there was discussion of wildfires, and it seemed as though that was a kind of an outlier data point related to, you know, as compared with our discussion of what's going on in the southeastern states. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
When we looked at the weather-related events and the climate scenarios, wildfires actually occur and are increasing mostly in the western and mountain states. But what was interesting was when we also then looked at these impacts, we also saw that wildfires tend to impact indigenous and Black populations at a 50% greater rate of vulnerability compared to white populations in the same area.
In the report, we also talk about hurricanes and flooding as other examples of impacts. I'm curious if you could tell us a little bit more about hurricanes, for instance. What are the implications there?
We see that Black communities in the Southeast are 1.8 times more likely than the overall population in the same area to be severely impacted by hurricanes, right? And by 2050, we believe that nearly 17% of Black-owned homes will be at risk of storm damage compared to 10% for other property owners. Property damage is one of the most direct physical risks of hurricane destruction. And in addition to that, it also results in higher insurance premiums for properties in high hurricane risk areas. And hurricanes can also lead to widespread displacement as well.
So what does all this mean in terms of the economic state of Black America and or the socioeconomic mobility of Black Americans?
If I look at what I would call the short-term effects, right? You know, I'll take extreme heat, for example. Black communities are 1.4 times more likely than the overall population in the same area to be exposed to extreme heat, right? And extreme heat can lead to reduced working hours, higher absenteeism at work, especially for jobs that need to be performed outside, like construction and agriculture. According to a 2021 report from the Atlantic Council, labor productivity losses due to extreme heat are expected to cost $500 billion annually by 2050, with Black and Hispanic workers facing proportional productivity losses at an 18% higher rate than white workers. In addition to the loss in labor productivity, it's also reported that the rates of emergency department visits for heat-related causes between 2005 and 2015 increased by 67% for Black people compared with 27% for white people.
Opening up the aperture a bit and trying to understand what the consequences for the Black population, what are the implications for the U.S. more broadly and the U.S. economy more broadly?
Those consequences impact the growth and productivity potential of the U.S. economy overall, and they contribute to increasing the racial wealth gap. There's other McKinsey research that has shown that dismantling barriers that prevent Black Americans from fully participating in the U.S. economy can unleash increased growth, dynamism, and productivity in the economy. One of the impact channels we talk about a lot is this impact on housing and property values. For Black families, property is 70% of the financial portfolio. And while this is not silver bullet solution for all the families and in all contexts, we know that homes can appreciate in value over time and significantly add to the net worth of families and often become an important means of wealth transfer to the next generation.
What are some of the things that the public and private sector can focus on now to help mitigate some of these potential effects for the Black community?
I think we need broader education, right, both around the impacts of climate change on Black communities, as we've started to outline in our research, but also to look at the implications on intergenerational wealth transfer, right, such as the effects on housing, which, as I mentioned, is a very important asset class for Black wealth transfer, and it is heavily impacted by physical hazards. Secondly, I think we need more engagement in Black communities, and this could be through engaging community leaders to help amplify the message, but also bring stakeholders to the table. The third example would be around financial inclusion of Black communities. When you look at companies, industries that are store-oriented, right, you look at stores, banks, and factories, they're going to start to think about how they reorient their footprints and their operations to address the climate risks that they face themselves. We should ensure, as this is happening, that we do not go back to a situation where services disappear from Black communities. The last example that we talk about is around providing equitable access to finance and providing opportunities to integrate Black entrepreneurs, be it in innovation hubs that support a transition to a green economy. But I think overall what's going to be most important is to make sure that we have Black entrepreneurship participation, we have Black job participation in a new green economy.
Are there examples of good public-private sector partnerships, or are there any good examples of groups or organizations that are starting to get this right, or, for instance, boosting financial inclusion or building broader awareness through broad education?
Absolutely. What the government has been trying to do in terms of, you know, defining frameworks around environmental justice, right, it speaks directly to the heart of this issue. And in a lot of that, there's a lot of, you know, community participation. Secondly, there is legislation already that is trying to increase participation of, you know, Black entrepreneurs, be it in supply chains that relate to the energy transition. Mm-hmm. I think thirdly, when you borrow from things like the CRA laws in the financial services sector, banks have been more thoughtful around thinking through their footprints, right, with regard to CRA, and I think could extend and apply the same as they start to think about how the physical risk from climate change starts to impact their footprints.
How could the public sector, private sector leaders, how could they prioritize? Where should they put their resources first?
Two potential ways to think about prioritization. The first one is location, which is really critical. And as I have tried to explain, if you take hurricanes again, for example, the majority of hurricanes impact the Gulf Coast and Atlantic seaboard, right? So you could start focusing there. Secondly, when you start to think about the impact channels, I think something that goes at trying to preserve and protect properties and property values, given that it's such an important part of Black wealth accumulation and transfer, could be another way of thinking about prioritization.
Munya, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for listening to the McKinsey Podcast. I'm Lucia Raheli.
And I'm Roberta Fasaro.
Find us on McKinsey.com. We'll have a transcript of this episode up shortly.
And download the McKinsey Insights app, where you can find this podcast and other helpful content updated daily.
If you enjoyed the show, we'd love for you to leave a rating and a review.
We'll see you in 2 weeks.